People of the world, lend me your ears, for 'tis time for the Activist Podcast. In this episode, I discuss my inability to find a monologue, my new experience of actually sleeping, and San Jose Rep's double indemnity. So let's get started. Well, hey there, friends. Happy belated New Year. How did you celebrate it? Perry and I spent the entire night geeking out with a dice game called Quarriors. Now, joining us was the BFF Brian while his wife was tearing up the dance floor with her girlfriends. Now, I mean her real girlfriends, not her girlfriends. You know what I mean, right? Okay, anyway, so it was pretty quiet night. I mean, if you don't count the fireworks that were being lit out in the streets. I've always been a bit geeky, but it was only recently that I've truly accepted it with open arms. So much so that I turned my Green Lantern belt buckle into a rearview mirror ornament. Yeah, I really did. However, my newly accepted geekery is not the topic this episode, so let's focus, shall we? All right. I've been looking happily for more monologues to memorize for future auditions. Let's see, I've read some Terrence McNally, Shakespeare, and some Chekhov, and a couple of other things, and I've definitely enjoyed reading them and imagining the way that I would stage them if I were directing. Then, just when I think that I've found one that I like, I'll mark it, and then I'll keep reading, you know, kind of want to keep going with the story. And then usually, about 24 hours later, I'll go back and reread the marked section. Now, sadly, I'll end up not liking it upon the second reading, and it seems to be for different reasons. First was practicality. In Chekhov's Ivanov, the character Sasha has a wonderful speech in Act 2, asking why everything must revolve around the title character. Why aren't the other men trying to do something, anything interested other than focus all this attention on one man? Now, I love it, but Sasha is a woman. I've heard so often that it's frowned upon to read an opposite sex because if the casting director or director know that particular play, they'll question your decision and wonder if you can make good decisions at all. Now, personally, I think if an actor can connect to the material and bring it to life without playing the gender, I would be impressed, honestly. Second reason that I have is I don't feel anything for the piece. Now, in Terrence McNally's Lips Together, Teeth Apart, there's a great piece for Sam in the first act where he speaks of his fear of losing his wife, as, like, divorce-wise, not like she's gonna die. But on the initial read, I really liked it. But when I went back and read it out loud, I sounded bored. I wasn't connecting to it on a level of truth that I did with the previous example. Now, my third reason for my inability to find the monologue was that the piece was just too long. Ew. I totally heard that. Yeah, I did. Hundreds of actors and listeners melodramatically rolling their eyes. Now, before you click your tongue and say, it's called editing, let me say I already thought of that. Let me just get onto the example. So, I decided to try the unconventional route, and I found a short story from Michael Thomas Ford's hilarious Alec Baldwin Doesn't Love Me. Now, the story is about his sister asking him to buy his 10-year-old nephew soundtracks for his birthday. and it turns out she means musicals, and goes on to say that the nephew knows all the words to Cats and Les Mis. He can even do the motions Grisabella does when she sings Memory. Now, there's funny bits about the possible implication this request has and the memories of his own childhood, and finally, the punchline. And there's so much good stuff in this bit that it well exceeds the 90 to 120 seconds of time that you get, but when you begin to cut it and fit it to your time frame, the charm and a lot of the funny is taken out, too. Ugh. So the search continues. I don't know how many years, I have suffered from insomnia. I mean, suffered sounds bad. I dealt with it and I adjusted my habits so I could still function. The only times that I could sleep for a full 7 hours would be after having a few drinks, if you know what I mean. As of late, I've had a ton of antsy energy. I've paced about the apartment and work so much more than usual, and I've consciously noticed it. During one of my days off, I took that energy and I did a massive winter cleaning, tossing stuff I no longer needed. But the apartment wasn't the only thing that I, you know, cleaned up. I made it through all 2,300 plus emails. I sorted and read, or sorted and tossed, and just got rid of them all together. I've went through most of my pictures on my computer and deleted the ones that are really badly out of focus, or the duplicate ones, or some lame movies that I tick, and I actually gained 4 gigs of memory on my storage. Oh yeah, and I began to actually start sorting my receipts for taxes. Woohoo! Now, I don't know if making the changes to the bedroom and adding the plants had anything to do with it, but this past week, I have slept so well that the dark circles under my eyes that I secretly, well, not anymore, obsess with, are lightening. For those of you that say I don't have dark circles, Smashbox Cosmetics says thank you for the compliment. But I feel that it's because of this that I've been so much more patient and chill. I still have some hyper moments, but they're all spread out throughout the day. I used to say sleep is overrated, but I have to say when I'm all snuggled up and warm, I kind of don't want to leave the bed. Sleep. It's a good thing. Days ago, I caught the first performance of San Jose Rep's Double Indemnity. In a synopsis I read, it states, and I quote, "From the dark and dingy streets of LA comes a treacherous tale of love and murder. The beautiful and seductive Phyllis Nerlinger unveils a cold-blooded scheme to murder her husband. but not before first taking out an insurance policy on his life, one which pays double if her husband dies in a fall from a moving train. Smart-talking insurance agent Walter Huff falls victim to the persuasive femme fatale, and, caught in a web of greed and lust, the adulterous couple commits the almost perfect crime, leading to guilt, suspicion, and betrayal. Unquote. But I don't think that's quite right. When I watched it, it doesn't appear to me that Phyllis unveils a plan, as it says in the synopsis. It's more like she plants seeds into the agent's head, who then ties together the plan. The movie version, which starred Fred McMurray and Barbara Stanwyck, was given a bit of extra romance and other fluff thanks to Hollywood's need to have a quote-unquote normal loving relationship. Originally, the Hays office was not giving the green light for this movie because they said that there were no likable people in the book. The book is leaner and bleaker than what Billy Wilder put on the screen. The play, adapted by David Pinchett and R. Hamilton Wright, derives about two-thirds of its dialogue directly from the book. It's snappy and cheeky, and especially my favorite part about the chow mein. You have to watch it to know. Now, overall, the show is fantastic. It was wonderful to see the characters shift throughout the show, only to end up at about the same finish line, so to speak. Now, Walter Huff, played by John Bogart, moves from lusty, slick salesman to scheming lover, to uncertain as to who actually has the power between the two of them, and then finally to defeated man. And then Phyllis Nerlinger, played by Carrie Paff, goes from beautiful, simple wife to seductress to cold-blooded killer. And then to faithful wife. When you see it, you'll understand. The other three actors, Jessica Martin, Mark Anderson Phillips, and Richard Zimmern, round out the cast, and they're the only ones who actually play multiple characters. And each character that they play is totally distinct from the previous. It's a great job. I don't know who to credit as the genius here, either the writers or the casting agents, but it's pretty damn awesome that the insurance agent Keyes is played by the deceased Mr. Nerlinger. So, really, he's actually, in a sense, investigating his own murder. It's great, great stuff. This play is less about romance and more about the lust and greed and jealousy that is so prevalent in the book. And nothing, to me, says this more than Thomas Lynch's huge triangular emerald green set piece that takes up so much space, and it's supposed to be the front of a ship, and it seems to be forcing itself into the center of the stage like a wedge. But what I loved about this particular piece was that it was brilliantly designed to morph. Throughout the play, the walls separate at the center to reveal like a whole new space on the stage. It's so awesome because it's completely unexpected. Although I think I might have just ruined it for you. I'm so sorry, but expect to love it anyway. In addition to that genius idea, the floor has double turntables as well as a pop-up gate that fits perfectly into its cutout on the floor. And it's all quiet too. There's no like hissing of the engine that, you know, has the gate pop up. It's really, really brilliantly designed. The costumes, oh my God, were sublime. I actually felt rich just looking at the clothes that Phyllis was wearing. And each piece seems like it just came right out of the era. So hats off to the designer, Annie Smart, for her fabulous eye. Now, Rick Paulson and Brendan Patrick Hogan's lighting and sound designs, respectively, are magnificent. They easily capture that noir feel with the shadow play and the constant gloomy sounding weather, and coupled with Adam Stern's music, the tension is so effectively achieved when needed. And my favorite moment of the show, all of these things come together, and it's when Walter goes to visit Mr. Nerlinger on the oil field at center stage. Like, slightly to stage right and downstage, Phyllis is writhing about on a bed and during their whole conversation, and there's like, Mr. Nerlinger says, you know, cover your ears, and then all of a sudden there's like this small explosion, and as soon as that explosion happens, Phyllis just pops up and seductively on the bed in this stunning red robe, and the shadows on the bed are still, they keep their integrity even though there's this bright, you know, light at the center of the stage, which is the oil field. It's like so awesome. I loved it. I was like, oh, it like took my breath away. Now, while I loved it, there are a few moments that took me out of the 1930s that I was watching on stage. Now, one of those moments was when Felix, oops, what kind of story am I trying to tell? When Phyllis attacks Walter with, I believe it's a letter opener. They never really show it clearly enough to be sure. But the stage combat really needs to be tightened up. When you're able to just, you know, go for it full out, it puts us on the edge of our seat more. And their bit was a little slow, and therefore it was kind of predictable. And another moment was the actual murder. Now, up until this point, the sound is perfection. The car door slamming and the gears shifting as he's driving. It's throughout the play so far, it's just fantastic. But then the scene where the actual murder takes place, it takes place in the car, and the same care about getting out of the car wasn't heeded. There were no car doors. You know, all of a sudden it was just people running around the car, and I was like, God, this is a big ass car. But, you know, so that kind of bothered me. And I know it was probably so it didn't slow down the action, but the fact that they were so dead on up until that point kind of bothered me. The other thing that, that kind of went, for me was the ending. And it happened so fast that the ending seemed to be a little on the unintentional comedy side because the audience laughed. And it's tricky because they jump off the ship and the gate and where they are trying to jump off is toward the audience. And they give like this shout and then they reach forward like they're about to jump. And just as the shout gets out of their mouths, the lights just shut off and everything goes dark. So it's like, ah! And then all of a sudden everything's, you know, cuts off. And so you're like, And I wonder, like, if the actors were still to do the same thing, but as they do it, as they're yelling, the lights, you know, there's a whole, like, a row of lights that are pointed directly at the audience. If as the actors are shouting, those lights just brighten out to blind the audience and do a complete whiteout, and then end with, like, the splash, and then everything blackout. So it's like, you have the bright, and then the off, and done. I wonder if that would work out better. It's just a thought, but, yeah. And lastly, and it didn't so much as bother me, but made me wonder. The actor, John Bogart, he did this weird thing with his hands. It's like he kept tension in his hands, and sometimes it looked a little awkward. Now, I don't know if it was a character choice, but when compared to, like, Paff's effortless naturalness on stage, it was enough to catch my attention, and I was just wondering if anyone else noticed that, too. That's all. But all in all, The Rep has a hit on its hands, and I highly encourage you to check it out if you can. Or if you can't, check out the book from the library. It's very near and true to the play. Well, kids, now it's time to say goodbye. Special thanks to this PodSafe Music Network and to all the artists who allow us podcasters to share their music for free. Pictures and links to some of the things I talked about will be on the show notes. Please feel free to contact me via the usual mediums, homing pigeon, USPS. Okay, only kidding. You can find me on Facebook at Jerry the Activist. Twitter is at TheActorVista, and email is jerry@theactorvist.com. For all my friends with shows and auditions, break some legs. For everyone else, go out and support live theater or museums like Empire 7 Studios, which just opened a new exhibit this past Friday. Until next time, thanks for listening. My name is Jerry, and I am The Activist.